Okay, and the first question is, noble silence must be biting. Huh? There's more and more questions. Dear Ajahn, in the next life, I want to be a monk. What can I do to make sure this happens? Why not this lifetime? I'm happy to suffer this time around. Basically, you have to cultivate, you know, the same kind of virtues that you would when you're a layperson. Do lots of meditation, practice generosity, practice restraint, and just keep up with the practice. Hang around monasteries and monks and nuns a lot. Basically, that's when you pass away. The mind will incline towards those kind of conditions that you set up. But it's true. The only guarantee of becoming a monk in this next lifetime is hopefully to be a monk this lifetime. You can ordain just before you die or something. No. Any questions or comments? Yes? Well, that's the thing. There is no guarantee, really, frankly. There's no guarantee in life. Once you pass away, different conditions take over. I mean, generally, you know, you can tell the rough directions, but there is no guarantee. Actually, you know, Cha's famous simile is the stick. And, you know, one end is your bad karma, and the other end is your good karma. And when you die, it's just tossed up in the, you know, up in the air. And which end it lands on is very difficult to know. Yeah. So there is no guarantee. Yes, more comments? Yes, Jasmine?
What about positive thinking?
Positive thinking goes so far. And yeah, generally the moment when you die, you want to incline your mind towards, you know, wherever the destination is. But there's no guarantee, right? It's the, you know, it's causes and conditions. Your karma take over. So wishing, willing plays a certain part, but there's no guarantee. But also,
There's no age limit to become a monk?
No age limit? Generally, it's up to the abbot. Sometimes, if you're a bit, you know, elderly, then the abbot will say, well, you know, maybe it's a strain on the sangha to look after. But if there's lots of young monks running around, then there's no problem.
Yeah. It seems like it's obscure.
Yeah, it is not so clear. But yeah, the question was, you know, there's... mentioned in the discourses of the Buddha, that the threefold knowledge. And one is knowing the rising and passing away of beings, meaning they can see. So people with those knowledge, yeah, maybe they can tell where you might end up.
Yeah.
Yes, there seems to be an indication that there are some beings who, because of their still mind, powerful mind, they can look and have a you know, an inkling of where, you know, the destination, next destination is. But yeah, but then, you know, how do you know that person really knows, right? Yes, it's all a bit... but what you can do is true. When you make offerings to good monks or nuns, when you bow to the Buddha, you can make that aspiration. All the virtues that I've cultivated this lifetime may be a cause and conditions for me to be reborn as a monk or a nun in the next lifetime. So you can do all you can to point yourself in the right direction, but still there's no guarantee. Yeah? There are no guarantees in life. Okay, any more comments or questions? What is the difference between piti and sukha? Do they appear in the mind without doing anything? How to make piti stronger? Yeah, piti sukha generally comes together. Well, according to Ajahn Brahm, they only separate in the third jhanas. So, do they appear in the mind without doing anything? Yeah, sort of. When you do nothing, then the mind becomes more still. And as the body becomes still, you get these waves of rapture comes up. And they manifest differently for different people. Sometimes it feels like your body is expanding, that you can feel this whole kind of room. It feels that way. Or it could feel very, very heavy, Like you're sitting like your body is made of stone, rock or something, that you cannot move. So it's heaviness. But it's not as long as the emotional content is that of peace and stillness and kind of pleasant feeling, then yeah, there's different manifestation. It could be the hairs in your body could be standing on end, sensation back in your neck, feels like that, or a bit of tingling sensation over your body. Those are different kind of manifestation of pitisukha, called rapture. Okay. How to make pity stronger? You stay in the present moment. You don't make anything. You don't do anything. That's how pity arises to begin with. So we ask this question. Get the wrong end of the stick. Yeah, you don't make anything. That's the whole point, right? You just gotta sit and wait. Any questions or comments? Yes? Well, pity is the state of stillness that, you know, a manifestation of stillness that arises when the mind is still and the body is settled. Compassion is more of an emotional thing, of wanting to, you know, to come out and alleviate the suffering of others. Yeah. So, compassion is more of an emotional tone that, you know, kind of impels us to act to alleviate suffering. But pity, I think, is inclined towards kind of stillness, of inward looking. Yeah. Ajahn, can you please clarify what you meant yesterday when you talked about the Buddha's extinction? Isn't Nibbana described as the deathless? Thank you. I keep forgetting to repeat people's questions when they ask in the back. Remind me to do that. But the Buddha's parinibbana, extinction, is is in many places in the sutta that when the Buddha died, he doesn't go anywhere. It's the deathless because he's not being born again, so he cannot die. So it's not like he's going off to this kind of realm anywhere up in the heavens, looking down. The Buddha is a person, actually, he's gone, completely gone. He's dead, truly. His body has become the four elements. And so that's, this is one of the teachings in the suttas. There are other more controversial teachings that there is something beyond the five khandhas. But anyway, basically, from the suttas, we do understand that when the Buddha died, it's like a candle. You know, Nibbana is like extinction. When the candle goes out, the wind blows it out, or the wick runs out, the heat goes out, the candle just goes out. Right? It doesn't go north, it doesn't go east, it doesn't go west, it doesn't go south. It just goes out. It doesn't go to heaven, it doesn't go anywhere the lands of other candles, appears. It doesn't go down to hell, it doesn't go anywhere. So that's what happens to the Buddha when he becomes extinct. He just disappears. Okay? And Nibbana is described as the deathless because we don't get, you don't get reborn, so you cannot die. And that's what the Sariputta said, It says, what is the, how do you become, how do you not end suffering? You don't get reborn. That's how you end suffering. If you're born, you're going to have a body, and the body is going to age, it's going to have pain, it's going to get sick. That's just part of the deal of having a body. Sometimes you have good karma, the body is healthy, but it's not going to be healthy forever, right? So the only way to avoid having a pains of the body, of being sick, is not to come back. Right? And we do that by letting go gradually. It builds up. The momentum of letting go builds up, and we don't come back. Not through willing, but because we set the conditions right. We set up the proper causes and conditions not to come back. Through not craving. Okay, any questions or comments? Excuse me? Yes. There are several questions. There's a comment. There are several questions that the Buddha did not want to answer. And this is one of them. Yeah, where did the Buddha go? Because it's not helpful to your practice. Basically, the practice is that we recognize there is suffering in our heart, in our mind, and that the thing to do is to end the suffering. however we can. What happens afterwards is not so necessary. Right? Yes. There's a comment in the back of the room by caretaker Dania that there are sutta classes on the second and fourth weekends in Alamara, and that in many of the suttas, the Buddha talked about, you know, Nibbana as being the cessation of consciousness, cessation of everything, ends, ceases. And it's very clear from the suttas. Yes?
But how can, I just don't get it, because complete light, happiness.
That's right.
And yet it seems like the kind of cosmic suicide that's being aimed at here.
Right. Yes, so we can talk this about this all night, and scholars have spilled oceans of ink and cut down, you know, forests of trees to answer this question. So if only I'd like to settle it tonight. But, and the Nibbana is different things to different people, and that's why you notice that the Buddha framed it in a way, certainly Ajahn Brahm does, that it's the highest happiness. But it's the highest happiness precisely, and this is a bit of a twist, it's the highest happiness because we ended suffering by not coming back. So it's kind of a reverse happy. It's like, what? Yeah, I know, people don't like it. But you have to also keep in mind that unless we are a stream enterer, we won't understand exactly Nibbana is. You can get a glimpse of it by, you know, reading the suttas and trying to, you know, analyze the words of the Buddha. But it's true. We don't really understand it. And because Nibbana is beyond words, yeah, basically. It's beyond the five khandhas. And we can go backward and forth. No, it's just here in the suttas that, you know, Nibbana is, you know, A, B, C, D, and F. But then you have other scholars who also point to the sutta and they say, no, it means, you know, whatever, X, Y, Z. I don't know, I'm not enlightened, so we have to leave these questions. Because you feel anything, feeling is, you know, ultimately, there are different sensations of feeling, but ultimately if you have peace, stillness, then feeling anything, even feeling happy feeling, is suffering. If you have the jhanas, you go through the jhanas, jhanas are, you know, successive stages of nothingness. So the more subtle, you know, the higher the jhanas you reach, the more the mind gets bliss and happiness from just nothingness. Yeah, it sounds a bit weird because we're caught up in the five sense world and we want to feel happy. But the happiness of Nirvana is not the happy of, you know, having a nice walk, you know, not the happiness of eating good food, not the happiness of friendship. The precise happiness of not being excited about those things. That's happy. That's why they keep saying peace is the highest happiness. Peace, stillness, nothing, emptiness is great once you get the hang of it. Boring is really good. Back to my favorite topic, boredom. Yes. Yeah, that's true. And there's no such thing as happy ever after, you know, after. Even in the very exalted heavenly realms, right? You can be happy for billions and billions of years, but ultimately you still have to come back. And that's why the Buddha said that's not desirable. Because he said in the suttas, he doesn't praise any type of being at all, on any different levels and any kind of anywhere in the world. So that points to, yeah, this kind of non-being, right? Emptiness, not coming back. But yeah, we can just leave it there for now. You can move on. You can find that in yourself. But that's a good goal. Once you get there, you please tell me about it, okay? You can come up here and give the talk. Dear Ajahn, can you comment on the relationship between intent and karma? Thank you. Intention, the last time the Buddha said, that is karma. When you intend towards, you know, wholesome states of mind, you're making good karma. When you intend towards unwholesome states of mind, that's making unwholesome karma. So the Buddha said in some of his discourses that karma is nothing but intention, really. Yeah, you're making karma when you intend. Yes? Any questions or comments? So it is one and the same thing. Intention is karma. Making new karma.
Also,
Well, that's part of it. But you can always, you know, like, you can always change your habit through your intention. Yeah. And karma is also another one of those big topics that Buddha says only he can really understand all the different permutations, intricacies of your karma. And but for most of us, roughly, it is intention. Yeah. And also, it's part of the habits and your makeup of mind. Yeah, it's all kind of interrelated. Yeah. Questions, comments?
Sometimes,
yeah.
Sometimes I wonder
how there was one who was like, yes, the question was, she wonders how can one person who can know all this, yeah, that's why he's the Buddha. Because he cultivated many, many countless of lifetime, they said, to, you know, to, for the spiritual perfections. And that's why there's only one Buddha in an age that can last billions and billions of years. Yeah, one at a time. And if his teaching is still around, then no other Buddha will arise. Because the teaching, only when the Dhamma, when the Buddha passed away, and also the Dhamma completely fade away, there's no teaching of the Buddha left, then another one arises sometimes in the future. Yeah, so it's a long, long, long time. Yeah. So those who are waiting for Maitreya to come, don't hold your breath. Yeah. Okay, questions or comments? There is one spot, one sutta, he says, in the future there's a Buddha and his name is Maitreya. Yeah, and so there's lots of speculations regarding that. But basically, as far as I understand, in one place, in one sutta, he just mentions that. Yeah. Yeah. What is the meaning of your four names? Do you choose your names? Do you like it? Let's start at the bottom. Buddha Rakita, can you explain your name?
I requested one teacher for a Pali name, and the tradition was that based on the day I was born, there's a certain sound related to that day, and then they give you a name. So that name, I didn't know what day I was born on. So the monk, he just thought about it, and then he said, Sulabha, and this means great gain. And then I checked later on, and I found that I had been born on a Friday, and Su is actually the sound that goes with Friday. So I asked him, oh, how did you know? And he said, the mind is a very strange thing. So I was very happy with that name. And then I took ordination in Burma, and I told the teacher that I was ordaining under, oh, I'd like to keep the name Sulabha. So then, at the end of the ordination, he said Buddha Rakita. And I said, oh, I thought it was going to be Sulabha. I said, Buddha Rakita is really long, and nobody's going to get this name, you know? And and I liked Sulabha. It seemed to be, you know, really auspicious, and it was kind of easy, and three syllables, and great gain. It sounds really good. Instead of this really flowery Buddha Rakita, which means the Buddha protects you. And but anyway, I just sort of sat on it for a long time, and I slowly, you know, thought about what the heck does this name mean, you know. And actually, everybody on that day was called Rakita. So I was Buddha Rakita, and the other person who ordained was Sangha Rakita. You know, it was a Rakita day. And then he used to have these other days. You know, there was a Siri day. So everybody was Dhamma Siri and Buddha Siri or something like that. So I don't know how he operated. But anyway, that's how you got the name. And so some people come to me and say, oh, you born on a Tuesday, because Bu is for Tuesday. So it's not true. Nah, not it. It's just something quite poetic. But the real Buddha Rakita is related to the Dhamma. You see, when we look into phenomena, when we really look at the phenomena arising and passing away and our experience of reality, then we are actually experiencing the Dhamma, and that knowledge is protecting us. And they say when we know things, when we know things in an ultimate sense, that this is the protection, because we're protected from ignorance. And when we see the Dhamma, we see the Sangha, and when we see the Dhamma, we see the Buddha. So this is the protection of the Buddha. The Buddha's protection, in an ultimate sense, is when the mind is knowing the object without any delusion whatsoever. So I like its fundamental meaning, you know, so I'm quite happy to struggle along with people mispronouncing my name. So that's the meaning of my name.
Okay. Well, I think with my name, Venerable Chundala, it came about, I think I wanted a name that was easier for other people to remember than say, because some of the lay people told me, Kim. My late name was Kim. They say, you choose a name. Choose something that's short and easy to remember. Because some of the monks' names is so complex, and it's very hard to say. So I go, okay. I'll try and find a simple name, but easy to remember, and something that I like. So when I was in the sutta class, I heard of this monk called Maha Chundal. I go, oh, okay, that's a nice name. Then he asked the advice to the Buddha, what's the best thing to do in practice? And the Buddha said, put a lot of effort in. So other people are lazy. Don't be lazy. Be very diligent. Practice well. And go against the stream of what other people do. So if people are taking it easy, you put the effort in to practice hard. If people are not willing to do things, you put the effort in to do things. Other people are unhappy and grumpy, you put the effort in to be happy. So basically it's just going against the stream of what everyone is doing in the world. And you go with the against the grain, so that you go opposite direction from what people are doing. So that's the best way to practice and see things clearly. And also the Maha Chundala, he also recited the Pojanga Sutta to the Buddha and to who's the other venerable?
There was 80 foremost arahants, and Mahachunda was the foremost in the fact that he had developed the parami of reciting the Bojanga Sutta to the Buddha when he was sick. And when the Buddha heard this, he recovered from this very serious affliction immediately. But this Bojanga Sutta was also recited by the Buddha himself to two other monks when they were sick. I think Mahakasapa was one of the monks who was sick, very chronically afflicted. And then when the Buddha recited this sutta, he recovered from that illness. And to this very day, monks recite this sutta for sick people. So Venerable Chunda has to know this one off.
My name is Venerable Santuti, and it means contentment. So yeah, that's all I've got to say.
Yeah, in the Thai forest tradition, it's actually your teacher give you the names, but some teachers do ask the students which names they prefer. And my name is Kema Waro. Kema is the synonym for Nibbana, means true refuge. It means the highest peace. And Waro, Waro is the highest. So Kema Waro is a very lofty name, something to aspire to, the highest peace. But also it's a bit of a pun on word, because Ajahn Jayasaro was a bit of a scholar. And Kema means security, ultimate security, and I was in the stockbroking. And he calls it the insecurity business. So now he gives me true security by being Kema, he says. So that's why. So that's why I'm Kema. Okay. Okay. No, it's just pure coincidence that I am looking after the monastery that I Kema donated to Ayakema was, when she was a layperson, actually bought the piece of land and donated to the Sangha, and also donated to the monk Kantipalo. And she lived there for a few years before going up to Sri Lanka to establish a nunnery. So that's why I'm staying. So what Buddha Dhamma? But it was the one of the monasteries that I came and helped to found.
Yeah. Okay.
Questions or comments? Dear Ajahn, I know the psychic powers are not the goal in Buddhism, but can you share with us a few stories? Thank you. But these things, yeah, it makes it more exciting and more entertaining. But it's true. It's basically a distraction. Most teachers would say, you want to, practice the divine ears, which means you can hear sounds at a distance. Get a telephone. You can hear. You want to go fly, go buy an air ticket. You can go on a plane. So these things are rather cheap these days. So don't waste your time kind of practice, because it takes years and years to perfect these kind of powers, and they're not worth very much these days. In terms of my own experience, the only one I know, but these things, it's hard to know, right? So, I was a novice, a young monk, not too much faith, and you hear the stories, we go visit different monasteries and different teachers, and so you hear that this monk has the three knowledges, which means he has all the psychic powers. He can read your mind. So he is a well-known Thai teacher. So I'm sitting in the back, he's talking, answering questions. So I close my eyes and think to myself, okay, so big guy, you have this, show me. I was just going to send this kind of wave out. And then I have a tattoo on my right arm. It's a dragon. So that's what I saw flying at me when I closed my eyes. But who knows, right? Could my own imagination. So but the teachers who have it, it's interesting what they say. They would never admit it to people that they have these things, because they said, you tell people you have it, then they will pester you all day long. Can you give me these lottery tickets? Can you give me that? Right. That reminds me of an Ajahn Chah story. So we have, Ajahn Chah, also very well, highly attained, enlightened, and huge reputation. So we have this villager, supporter of him, who kind of, goes to the monastery to help fix things, do things for the monks. But he, also had a little bit of craving. So he says, Ajahn, I heard you've got all this kind of psychic, powers. Why don't you give me the number for the lotto? It's like, no, that's not what I do. So, oh, come on, Ajahn, I've been coming here 20 years or whatever. I feed the monks, I drive you guys around. Just one number. It's like, no. And then he says, oh, I know why you don't do that. You don't have it. you don't have the psychic powers, right, Ajahn? Just admit it. Just you don't have it. It's like, he's trying to bait the Ajahn. Ajahn's like, okay, I'll show you something. I'm not going to give you the number, but I'm going to, he writes it down. He writes the 8-digit number. He says, I'm going to put it here. Come Monday, when they announce the number, you come and you take a look. He says, okay. And yes, on Monday, he came to take a look, and those exact same numbers. That's a lotto. So he knew something. So, like I said, these are kind of interesting, but they are a distraction, because when we sit and we, instead of kind of, allowing things to fade away, little craving stones of, because it depends on your meditation. Some people are more prone to visual stuff. And then once visions appear, then you start to play with it. And that could take lots and lots of time away from kind of cultivating peace and stillness. So generally, yeah, it might increase faith, but then again, it may not. Because people who have faith will believe these things. People who don't have faith says, well, there's kind of, hocus pocus anyway. So that's the reason why it's not really widely discussed. Only in certain situations, the teacher, if he thinks, it might increase your faith, he might say something. But generally, it's pretty much a shut book. Especially, there are rules against, monks telling lay people that they have these things. You can only discuss with other monks your psychic abilities or lack of. Yeah. Okay, any other questions or comments? Right, but also it's lots of projections and stuff like that, so it's never a sure thing. I was trying to remind people, yeah. That's right. But it's also, I also say, not sure. Maybe it's not there, maybe it's imaginations. What I was going to say was that, there certainly is a lot of projections, and I would say, 99% of these stories, unless you know for yourself, are highly suspect. Yeah, so I wouldn't put too much stock into them. They're entertaining, but no more than that. Yeah. Questions or comments? Okay, moving on. Can you please further discuss ways of avoiding becoming irritated during meditation? I'm constantly distracted by a person making a clicking, sucking sound, followed by a labored exhale every couple of minutes. Whilst others in the surrounding area seem totally unfazed, how can I avoid becoming frustrated and angry and stay focused on the present moment? Yeah, welcome to life. I mean, this is what happens when you're in a meditation room. There's always one person who makes lots of noise, always one person who makes clicking sound, one person who slams the door, one person who wears noisy clothing, every single retreat. But yeah, after you've been to a few retreats, you're not so fussed, actually, for some reason. You just get adjusted to it. The mind is also a very kind of a flexible thing. First time, when you're not used to it, it's a bit annoying. But other, you know, once you start to focus on your breath or your meditation object, things just fade away naturally. And also just kind of bring up positive mental states. That one, everybody's here comes with really pure intention of training the mind and inclining towards peace and kindness. And yes, we are human, not unenlightened, not don't have perfect mindfulness, so we do slam door from time to time. We do, you know, whatever, run into people or, make funny sounds. But, also remember Ajahn Chah's famous saying, right? It's not the sound that disturbs you, it's you that disturb the sound. So reflect on that. That the sound, 2 seconds, is gone. But the dialogue, the whinge that comes after the sound is much more disturbing than the sound. So that suffering is really self, you know, induced. Yeah. Slamming the door is 0.2 seconds is gone. It's like, I can't believe that guy slammed the door. I'm here. Doesn't he know? Noble silence. This and that other stuff. And 20 minutes later and we're still, you know, there. It's like the door is gone. Yeah. So reflect on that and try to, you know, and also to know that irritations, you know, is a defilement. It's just making trouble for ourselves, right? Even if it's intentional, someone just slamming the door right behind you all the time. Even that, you know, it's if you hold that, it's still, you know, not healthy, right? But it's a training of the mind. Yeah. Any questions or comments? That's right. You know, one comment was that the sound can actually, you know, bring you back to the present moment. Breaks your train of thought, breaks your, you know, sloth and torpor, you're falling asleep, someone, you know, sounds, wakes you up, oh, thank you. Where's my breath? So not always a bad thing, yeah. Similarly, that's why sometimes I meditate, you know, with the group. I find that as well. It's too quiet and I do kind of, you know, you tend to go to kind of la-la land after a while. But there's just slight sound, a rustling sound, or people moving a little bit. That's enough to keep you kind of there in the present moment, actually. So it's not entirely bad. Yes. Thank you for the comments. Okay, moving on. Dear Ajahn, why do some people breathe so loudly? Okay, you go talk to this person, okay? It's a good breath, a quiet breath. We'll take these people more lifetimes to become enlightened. Santuri, do you want to answer this? Remember, peace, kindness, harmony, come on. Right. Yeah, sometimes some kind of yoga exercise that they do, you know, kind of heavy breathing. That's a good point. To remind people as well that you don't have to sit in the hall. You can sit in the room, you find it more quiet as well. yeah, and sit outside. Yeah, there's 200 acres there, 150 acres. Hopefully we can all spread out. What is the karmic consequence of cheating on your partner? Thanks. The obvious thing is just fear insecurity, because you know you're afraid that this person will also cheat on yourself, right? Yeah. So it's the law of karma. What goes around comes around. So you can think on that one. And it's true. And basically, with anything, you know, you take things from another person, you steal. You tell a lie. These things, you know, they have a negative mental imprint, in that we will always think that somebody was lying to us. If we don't keep the precept of telling the truth, then we always worry, you know, is that so-and-so not telling me the whole truth? Because we lie, we know that it's possible. So that's the thing that makes it really uncomfortable. And by keeping the five precepts, I think it's a wonderful thing. Because by, you know, being harmless, not hurting other people, not hurting ourselves, you feel lots of confidence. You feel almost invincible because you have this harmless intention to offer to the world. And that's what you offer to the world, that's what you get back in return. Right? So you're feeling low, you have self-esteem problem. Keep the five precept. Then you know that people, you know, they can talk behind your back, they say things, but you know that, you know, your conduct has been pure, your intention has been pure. So what people may say and criticize you, you know that you yourself, you tried, you know, the best you can. So yes, the karmic consequence of cheating on your partner is that, yeah, obviously it's going to take a toll in the relationship, and obviously only the Buddha know the exact karmic result of this. But the general thing is, yeah, that, you know, obviously this will come around to bite you. You'll be cheated again, or this person find out, obviously, you know, will give you a lot of trouble, basically. Questions or comments? Yes? Sorry?
I'll ask a slightly different question.
Yeah. Yes, it gets very tricky, this thing. But it's the question is, I have to repeat it, sorry for the tape. If your intention to do good things is to increase your karma credit, is that still valid, or is it still good? Generally it is, because you're practicing generosity, you're giving things that you could have, then it's still bringing good karma. But giving in front of people, you know, put donation, you make sure everybody's looking when you clink your coin. You donate a building, you want your name over it, this is the whatever Kemawaro building, Kemawaro library. Then there is the positive karma is obviously you're donating something of use to other people. But the negative thing is that, yeah, then this attachment will bring you suffering. So, you know, attachment in any form, shape or form brings, you know, the suffering that comes after it. But I think it's still, people have to start somewhere. So generally, you people give, and it's, you know, kind of what is it called? Expected that they want something in return. Unless you're fully enlightened, then very few people give without expecting return, even to acknowledgement even. Oh, I do everything for you and you don't say thank you or whatever. So there is some, you know, and it's normal. People give things and want to expect in return. So on one hand, it's normal. But on the other hand, it's more pure and more beautiful. People who give anonymously, who do things without being asked, clean up without, you know, people look, you know, having around people look. So, each and every one of us, we're on different parts of the path, and we cultivate what we can. But certainly it's more pure to do things without being noticed, without being asked, without, you know, having this intention of getting anything in return. Yeah. Yeah, any other questions or comments? Yes?
Another question.
Yeah.
Can you, as monks, if you're living, there is
question. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yes. There's a question, was that as a monks, if we live somewhere that is either termite infested or rat infested, what do we do? Right? That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's a tough one. But also to remember that although we intend and our intention is not to harm beings, by the fact that we live, you know, and we need shelter and we eat food, that we have to acknowledge that we will cause suffering and death and harm to beings around. I mean, even, you know, if you're vegetarian, the produce that they bring to you has to be transported on cars that crushes bugs every so often or whatever. Sometimes they use insecticides. If they don't, even this place, it was built, they move things on the earth, so that causes some. Obviously, we want to minimize it, but it's inevitable when we live and survive, we will cause the death and destructions of small beings. That's part of the path. And we try to minimize it. And in terms of the situation of kind of termites or rats, that's a chronic problem when we live in the forest. But we have, just a rat trap that are called humane one, just basically a chamber they go into and they get caught, and then we release them somewhere far away from the monastery. Yeah.
Because I do have mice in my house.
Yes.
I'm having trouble getting rid of them.
Right. And, yeah, no, there's lots of kind of those kind of little traps that you bring.
That hasn't worked.
You have to bring it 10 kilometers away. You throw it across the street, doesn't help. Yeah. No, I said you have to take it. We take it 10 kilometers away from the monastery. Some people just go across the street and they just release it and it comes right back. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the monastery, that's just an ongoing problem. We have, what are you going to tell? We have rats. No, we don't have rats. We have cats. That's also a deterrent. Yes? Any comments, questions? I think the way they process it these days, those don't have, those are unfertilized eggs, I've been told. But also, some eggs are fertilized. I think the monks, our rule is not to consume any meat. There were no herd or suspect that was killed for us specifically. But if it's already dead, then it's not an infringement of the rules. But but vegetarian has different kind of grades. So some people can eat cheese and eggs. But I think, I don't know what the standard here is. I think it's generally vegetarian, but I think eggs is allowed, but I'm not sure. But as a monk as well, our rules is to accept. So that's why sometimes whatever people bring, we just look at the purity of their intention. If someone, bought something, go home and cook it, they bring it to the monastery, whether it's vegetarian or it's a meat dish, it's not so important for us. We just take it. It's just to honor the intention of someone giving something to us. Yeah. So that's why in our tradition, we are not strict vegetarian that way. Yeah, I think the being a vegetarian is positive, but it's the intention for you to break the first precept of harming. You have to literally kill something, right? So, and also the intention. Let's say you're a vegetarian and you eat, but if you squat a mosquito, that's heavy. That's also it brings. That's harming for sure because the intention of squashing something. So intention has to. You have to intending to kill something. Eating meat that's already dead already is residual. Obviously, you're feeding the whole industry that kind of, they wouldn't have meat unless people eat it. So there is residual. But just remember, we are making karma 24/7, right? Every moment. So you're eating vegetarian, which is good, but then, criticizing people who don't or saying things that are untrue, then that's also karma that's coming back. So it's just sometimes this focus on kind of what we eat, what goes into our mouth, but what goes out of our mouth, it also has karmic consequences, right? So that's the thing. But it is good, but it's not a practice in and of itself. It's got to be kind of temper, complemented with, loving kindness, towards all beings and outside of your eating time. Yeah. Questions or comments? It could kind of come back. It can rebound quickly, yes. And there's different stories about, harming things. And obviously, it's not meant for to bring remorse or guilt. Obviously, sometimes when we're kids, myself, you know, hurt innocent animals or whatever because you don't know any better. That's what kids do. But you can always establish a mind, you know, going forward, now that I know the precept, yeah, I'm going to try as best as I can to avoid harming or hurting animals intentionally. Obviously, you walk in, you're unmindful, you step on an ant, yeah, it's not the end of the world. You know, we're not going to kick you out of the retreat center. Yes. Okay, moving on. Dear Ajahn, after having a good meditation, I can't help but want to do it again, which seems to be counterproductive. How can I get around this? Yes. Yes. And this is the constant problem that a lot of people will come up against. Usually you get your best meditation, hopefully this is a warning, you get your best meditation your first week. After that, it's downhill for another 10 years. Because you don't know what you're doing, you're not expecting. And it's like, wow, it's amazing. I do this all the time. It doesn't work that way. So I think my personal take on that is, yeah, your good meditation the first week is like all the great karma that you made up and all the good meditation you made in the past. And so it's giving you the taste. And then the time it takes you to get back to there is your amount of craving you have inside in this present life. And for, you know, some people, it's a lot. You know, if it's a wonderful experience, then you want it back. And the stronger you want it, the higher the walls come up, right? Because meditation, in its heart, it's about letting go, making peace. So, want to do it again is looking towards the future already, right? So the question people should ask during meditation should never be, what should I do next? You've lost the plot. You ask me, what should I do next? Nothing. What you do in the present is what matters, right? So just stay in the present moment. The mind will open up. As long as you don't have go reaching towards, you know, the future or grasping towards the past, thinking, oh, that's really good. No, I wonder where's this going. Just stay in the present moment. Stay still. Still as you can. And then the mind will open up naturally when you least expect it. And that's the thing. I mean, many monks will tell you, you know, a lot of times you're sitting down, a bit tired, the room is really noisy, not expecting anything, and bang, the mind opens up. So it's not what's happening outside that's so important. It's what's happening inside your mind, your heart. Yeah. And once you learn the trick, then you can always press that button anytime you want. Button of letting go. But until you get there, you know, it's just lots of trials and you have to work it through. Yeah, any questions or comments? Okay. Dear Ajahn, how many hours per day do monks meditate? Should we go down the line? No. This is also up to individual temperament and also depends on what's happening in the monastery. Yeah. But generally, there's certainly lots of free time to meditate. And also during the rains, when not much is happening, people do meditate more. I guess anywhere between 6 and 8 or 4 and 8. But also, just remember, it's not the number of hours that you meditate, right? If it's just sitting still, we get you to Nibbana. If just logging in the hours to get to Nibbana, then Ajahn Chah would say, you know, the chickens are all enlightened. Because they sit on their eggs, you know, hours after hours after hours, days after days. They all would be enlightened by now. But it's more than that. It's the quality of our mindfulness. Yeah. It's the quality of the meditation, not the quantity. Obviously, sitting a lot and working with the mind will help you learn different things. You know, how to quiet the mind, how to let go of things. So it's true. If you never sit down, that would be very difficult to get good meditation. But once you sit down, it's the beginning. But it's the letting go. That's the trickier part. We can all log in the hours, but it's a very rare individual who can completely let go of, you know, his or her thinking and craving mind. Yeah. But generally, I would encourage people to sit more rather than less, but also know that it's just one of the factors for a good meditation. It's not everything. Yeah. Yeah, any questions or comments? Generally, when you're meditating a lot and the mind is fairly bright, yeah, you don't need much sleep. Yeah. 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 And also, it's more of an organic process. When the mind is still and is bright and is happy, then you sit longer and longer and longer naturally. It's not something that you kind of can push yourself. And that's, so that's why you hear some stories of, you know, good monks and nuns. Yeah, they said, oh, you know, I sat, closed my eyes, and hell, it's great meditation, feel really peaceful and happy and still. And I opened my eyes, and oh, it's only an hour. He's like, oh, I thought it was longer than that. And then he looked again, it's actually a day after. It's like 25 hours. But it's not like he's sitting there counting the hours. It's not like, oh, 1 hour, okay, 2 hours to go, another 23 hours to go. No, it's just things become still. It just goes. Right? Or monks, you know, I go out of my chung, you know, I get on my walking path, I walk backwards and forwards, and, you know, just like walk on air. 6 hours later, I go sweeping. It's just like, yeah. So it's like that. Time doesn't really become so meaningful when the mind becomes still. Right? So just to know that, yeah, when we were sitting, just kind of work with our own body and not to be so concerned with the clock. Yeah. Yes? Myself, yes, I still do alarm clock. I'm waiting up at 2 for some reason because I'm still on Sydney time, I think. And yeah, just to make sure you're on time. But generally, Ajahn Brahm does encourage during the rains retreat not to use the alarm clock. And sometimes, you know, in the monastery, because there's so little schedules, yeah, we generally don't need so much alarm clock just to get ourselves up. But it does vary, and I wonder how much work we're doing, how much sleep we get. Yeah. After jhana, what does one have to realize? What must happen to get out of samsara? Only enlightened one can tell you how to get out of samsaras. But I think, you know, from different teachers and what the sutras said, after jhanas, you're meant to contemplate the three characteristics. There's a host of different things to contemplate, but in contemplate impermanence of your body, impermanence of the conditions that came together for the jhanas. You can contemplate non-self, what's this thing that we call the self, a body, a mind, and contemplate what is suffering. So those are the three, they call the three gateway to the deathless. Yeah. And it's contemplating, yeah, like I said, you know, it has more power after a jhana because the mind is really still, it has power, but only after jhana. In jhana, you're single-pointed, so there's no contemplation while you're, you know, meditating. You leave that to the end when the mind is really still. It's got some oomph behind it. Okay, any questions or comments? Moving along. Dear Venerable, could you please explain the difference between equanimity and apathy? Author Bhante Sujata suggests that it's more skillful for new meditators to focus on the cultivation of metta primarily rather than upekkha, because it's easy for beginners to mistake equanimity for apathy. Would you agree with this theory? Thanks with metta. Yeah, it's true. Equanimity is not apathy, it's not indifference. Is the kind of a wisdom faculty of knowing the law of karma, that people, you know, as much as we try to help them, people are subject to their laws of their own law of karma. They make bad intention, they will, you know, have to pay for that, and no one can intervene. But there's also this kind of this feeling that, let's say you and your friend had an argument, so he or she's angry with you, and you know that you try to kind of approach them to reconcile. It's not the right time because they're still mad at you. So it's not saying, oh, I don't care about you. I don't, you know, I want to get, you know, get out of my face. But it's this kind of caring, but at a distance. That knowing that, okay, you're going to wait until this person gets over this argument. And then when the time is right, you're going to approach and try to do things to alleviate, you know, increase the happiness, alleviate the suffering. So it's this kind of readiness, this awareness and readiness to help when the time is right. But until then, you sit and you wait, not worried about it. So it's not like, you know, it's not a kind of apathy or indifference or ill will that you don't want anything to do with this person because, you know, you had an argument and they annoyed you or they did something wrong. But it's, I still care, but I know that at this time, you know, you may not have faith in me, you don't trust me anymore because of our argument, and that I'm not going to be very productive in helping to ease the situation. So I'm just going to watch with concern, with care, but just watch from afar. So that's upeka. Right? And Bhante Sujatos, about focus on metta, yes, yeah. Generally, upeka is a quite a lofty emotional state as well. You know, the Buddha said there's four, divine abidings. First is metta, is feeling of friendliness, loving kindness, and then the next is compassion, right? Is karuna, and this is the instinct, the emotional state of wanting to alleviate people's suffering, right? And to help whatever ways you can, to go out to help people, to alleviate their suffering. Third is mudita, and that's really nice, and I think that's not discussed much, but it's kind of appreciative joy of, you know, seeing the goodness in others and rejoicing in the success of others, right? You know, happy when someone scored a goal, happy when someone got a promotion, happy when someone has good meditation. For most of us, for the world, it's the opposite, jealousy, right? It's like, I've been sitting here and I don't get nothing. And this person just sitting there with a smile on their face and it just came in. You know, so why can't I be the billionaire? Why Bill Gates to get everything? So things like that. But what we're trying to do with mudita is just to do the opposite. You know, to kind of rejoice in people's success. And, you know, Ajahn Chah said that this is the lazy man's way to nirvana. Because when you rejoice in another person's goodness, you also get part of that karma. So you hear Bill Gates give, you know, $1 billion or $5 billion to feed the poor in Africa. Instead of saying, I could have been that. You say, oh, it's great that Bill Gates has this, you know, the wealth to give away. It's great that he has this pure intention to make a difference in the world. By rejoicing that, you have a partial kind of stake in the good karma he's making. So it's a very wholesome state that brings up brightness and lightness in the mind. Instead of jealousy, it's this kind of dark thing, you know, all about me and myself. And so mudita is a great way. And upeka, like I explained, it's this equanimity in the face of, you know, that the law of karma applies to individuals. And also, you know, that, so that's why you exercise kind of care, but at a distance. And to know when the time is right, then to act upon it. But until then, you know, you still care. But you know that you try to do something, if the person is not listening to you, it might be counterproductive. So you refrain from doing it, you strain yourself. Yeah? Does that make sense? Questions or comments? Okay. I think it depends on different people, whatever works. Initially, just you kind of feel that emotion. You feel like, oh, this is not very nice. You know, you're tensing up or, you know, feeling thing. Yeah. So you try to kind of calm that down. Let that, those kind of negative emotional states go. And then sometimes it's not so easy to do it in that moment because envy comes up. It's hard to feel kind of happiness for another person once envy already come up. So it's slightly too late. But when you've calmed down and when you practice meditation, then you can bring these feelings up. And that's why, you know, like, you know, with metta and karuna, mudita, you know, with kind of loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, or equanimity, these things, that's something we practice over and over again. Case of, you know, fake it until you make it. You kind of repeat it. No matter how silly it sounds, it sounds really saccharine sweet. May all people be happy. It's like, oh. Someone says, nothing more annoying than metta meditation. But, you know, you've got to start somewhere. And actually, and once you get a hang of it, it's really a wonderful thing. Really a joyous thing to cultivate this, you know, this feeling in the mind that embraces and cares for all beings. Questions or comments? Okay, final question. Dear Ajahn, why don't the monks wear beanies inside the meditation hall, even when it's really cold? Thank you. There's one sitting there. Now, I think it's a general guide that we try to leave our head bare out of respect in a holy place for the Buddha. But we're also practical. It was really freezing cold, we wear. Yeah, so here, because we have central heating and stuff, so there's no need to wear it. But at the Wat Buddhadhamma, where it's freezing cold, it's, you know, it's 2 degrees or something, then we're all, you know, we're all wearing it, putting things on our head and stuff. Yeah. So it's a general thing. It's not you know, strict guidelines. In kind of the in our tradition, there's a few etiquette, but generally guidelines, really, and allow people to feel what's appropriate for themselves. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Good. Thank you for all those questions and your comments. And you continue sitting, or call it a night. Yeah.